Books for young people tend to picture an idealized world in which Dick and Jane watch the dog Spot jump. Sometimes, Dick's name might be Diego, but is that the world children actually live in? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. It's time for our annual Alaska Spirit of Reading Book Club in cooperation with Alaska School Librarians. Statewide phone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Storyteller Roxana Khan is our guest today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
My taste in children's books tends toward the ironic, I would say. Roald Dahl is a big favorite of mine, and Maurice Sendak. Things that some might say is not really proper for young people. And I always wonder what I'm going to get when I do this Spirit of Reading show. And we have an author available to us who was picked out by school librarians. Is it going to be Dick and Jane and Spot? And it never is. They've all been uniformly great and interesting. And that's the case this time, too. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roxana Khan.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So you just got back from Valdez, fortunately. Could have been weathered in there very easily. And I guess you were speaking to librarians from all across the state?
Yeah. On Saturday night, I did a kind of an intimate gathering where I was talking a little bit about how I became an author and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And so now you're here. And I'm really glad to have you here. To give a little bit of your background, you were actually born in Pakistan, but at a very young age, moved to Canada and mostly to the Toronto area, right?
Yeah, like I came when I was like 3 years old.
And your religious persuasion, you're looks like you're Muslim to me.
Yeah, I'm Muslim. It was a real challenge.
but you're in a city with a number of other people who are Islamic.
Yeah. But my father's idea was actually to get away from some of the Pakistani notions of Islam and kind of influence us with his own ideas. So that's one of the reasons he moved us to a little town where we were the only Muslims there. And we did have contact with the Muslim community, but for the most part, he's the one who molded us in his shape.
But nonetheless kept to the customs?
Oh, yeah. Especially the prayer and reading Quran, things like that.
Uh-huh. So I just wanted to throw that in as a, with the ground rules here at the beginning.
Sure.
So these books, I have an array of your books around the studio here that the librarians were good enough to send to me, and I've actually read them all. And some of them are for real little kids, and some of them are for young adults.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to go to the young adult one first.
Sure.
And that is Wanting More, M-O-R. Yes. What is the word more? What is that? Slang?
Well, more, when I was thinking of what to call it, it's actually based on a true story. It's based on the story of this Afghan girl whose mother dies during the war. Her father gets remarried. Stepmother doesn't want her. So the father takes her to the marketplace and he leaves her there. And as I was writing it.
That's extremely tough. I mean.
Yeah.
This is like huge.
Yeah, it's basically about loss, abandonment. And to me, it's like a Hansel and Gretel story without the Hansel. Okay. And I thought, when I was writing it, I thought she really just wants her mother. And in Pashto, the word for mother is more.
Ah.
And I thought, okay, wanting more. And but she also wants M-O-R-E. So she wants both. She wants her mother and she wants more because she's got nothing.
Yeah, she's got nothing and she gets left on a street corner, not even taken to an orphanage.
Yeah, Yeah.
I mean, this is bizarre. She does end up in an orphanage, though.
Yes, yes. Basically, I took the what really happened. It was a paragraph in a report that was sent to me from an orphanage in Afghanistan. And in this orphanage, I'd actually sponsored a library with the proceeds of my book, The Roses in My Carpets. And that was my second book, and it's about my Afghan refugee foster child. So ever since I wrote it, I thought, you know, I'm going to use the money from this book to help other refugees. And then I got enough of an advance from my third publisher for that book to help sponsor a library in this orphanage in Afghanistan. And then they sent me this report about the kids, and that girl's story was in one paragraph. And it just broke my heart. I thought, oh, what would that feel like? And then I started to look at it, too, because within my own extended family, the same scenario was playing out. Because my sister, she died about 9.5 years ago. And a year before she passed away, no, a year before she was diagnosed, her husband ran off with another woman. And when she passed away, she was left with her kids were left with a deadbeat dad. So when I read the story, I think that's one of the reasons why I got so emotional, because the same thing was happening, different continent, but the same story. And I thought, how many kids does that happen to where their father abandons them? And, you know, but I mean,
Roxana,
mm-hmm.
What's exceptional about you is you put it in children's fiction.
Well, that's what kids are dealing with. I mean, we think kids are like, it's all rosy, rosy dozy, and it's not. I mean, kids are going through really hard times. In fact, when I do the presentation on that book, and I ask kid audiences, put up your hand if you know someone. I don't say if it was you, because that would be too personal. But if you know someone that's happened to, where the father's run off, and at least half the kids will put up their hand. That they know someone, that the father has run away. And I think it's like an epidemic. And I think it's terrible, because the father is actually an important part of the family.
And we haven't even got to people having their limbs blown off.
No.
Losing to where you actually, there's nothing left of your family.
Yeah.
Minefields. You talked about this book, The Roses in My Carpets,
mm-hmm.
and that is very much about minefields. And it's quite elegant.
Thank you.
And it's really just a metaphor.
Thank you. You know, The Roses in My Carpets, I still consider it one of my best books. And
I got to have the story of how you came to write this, because you just said, I got a foster child, a refugee from Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, okay, it goes back to when I was growing up. You see, I grew up in a very small town, in Dundas, Ontario, and it was in the 60s and
70s. I've been there, yes. It is
Have you
small.
Been to?
Yes.
Yeah, it's very small. And growing up, all the kids used to tell me and my sisters that we're white because we're clean and you're brown because you're dirty. Mm. And I grew up feeling dirty. And I tried everything I could to get the brown off my skin, and I couldn't. And instead, I had to come to terms with it. I grew up, we heard about the war in Afghanistan, and we thought, and I said to my husband, I said, we should sponsor a child. Got a picture of our foster child, and he had blonde hair and blue eyes and freckles. This kid was white. And I thought, oh, isn't that ironic? So when I went to Pakistan, I went there 20 years ago, and I thought, I want to go meet this kid. I never knew there were any white Afghans. I thought they were all brown like me. I went there, I met him, and I wrote the story, The Roses in My Carpets, based on that meeting. So it's based on a true story. And I thought, you know what? This story, it's about the bombs and everything, but it's actually more about self-sufficiency. And the funny thing is, when my father read it, he said, that's my story, because it's about a boy who doesn't want to take charity. He's a foster child, but he doesn't want to be fostered. He thinks it's beneath him. He thinks his father would be disappointed in him. And that's what the story is really about. Even though it's also about everything else that's happening, but it's actually about self-sufficiency. And when my father read it, because my father had a lot of pride. When we first started in Canada in 1965, when he came over, he had a good paying job. He was a tool and die maker. He made $7 an hour. Within a year of buying the house in Dundas and my brother and sister being born, now there are four kids in the family, he lost his job. He was making only $2.35 an hour. We could have gone on welfare and made more money, but my father refused. He said, no, I'm not going to take charity. Sometimes he would work 16 hours a day. And then when my brother-in-law ran off like this, I was shocked, because I always thought he was such a nice guy. And then I started to think about my dad. And I thought, you know, $2.35 an hour, he was working so hard. If anybody would have run away, it would have been my dad. And I thought, why didn't he? So I went up to him one day and I asked him, I said, how come you didn't leave? It was really hard. And my father said, you know, He said, when you have a clay pot and you want to make it strong, you put it in the fire. And if you take it out of the fire too quickly, it will crack and be useless. And he said, you know, we are the children of Adam. God made Adam out of clay. So we are made out of clay. And when I was going through all of that, I figured that God is putting me in the fire. I have to wait and be patient until he takes me out, or else I will crack and be useless. And I thought, wow. And that actually became the theme of Wanting More. In fact, I put that story in the first chapter.
I'm thinking about how I asked you if you wanted to read on the show, and you said, well, I'm a storyteller, so it might be better if I just tell.
Yeah.
and it is. I want to go to the roses in the carpets, because here's a boy that weaves, makes carpets.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a very short book, and I can say just, I think, not to give away a plot, but it doesn't have much of one. But
it's basically one day in his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the carpet, he makes carpets and he puts roses in them. One reason is because he lives in a world that's all brown and gray.
Yeah. He yearns for beauty. I think everybody yearns for the aesthetic. We all yearn for some beauty in our lives. And the thing is, I kind of resent it. Sometimes I resent it that sometimes North American people feel like they are entitled to a peaceful life and everybody else, oh yeah, if they go through something or if they're going through hell, I mean, that's their problem. I mean, you know, it's their tough luck that they weren't born in North America. And actually, I think the default setting of everybody is happiness. And when I went to Pakistan, I met my foster child. The problem was my actual foster child turned out to be too happy for my purposes. He was like a happy little kid. He hadn't remember. He left Afghanistan when he was just a baby. So he was no use to me at all. He was just a happy little kid. It was his older brother. And he was always skulking around in the background. He's the one that actually turned out to be about the story. When I was looking at him. And I put myself into his position to write the book. And that book actually took me 4 years to write, whereas Wanting More only took me 5 months, even though Wanting More is a novel, and that's a short picture book.
Wow. And interestingly illustrated, I think.
Yeah, the guy who illustrated is Ronald Himley. He's really good.
Yeah.
He's done about 100 books in the States. He's very good. He's from Tucson, Arizona.
Well, the thing is that somehow this carpet is going to be magical. It's not going to be a minefield.
I think the carpet represents his own ability. And I think it's always our own ability that we rely on. And it also represents his dreams and hopes and just a place where he can be safe. His family can be safe. And it rests on his own ability.
We're talking with Roxana Khan. She is the author of The Big Red Lollipop, The Roses in My Carpets, Wanting More, Bedtime Balk, and she's with us live. She is the author brought to Alaska by Alaska Spirit of Reading by school librarians, and we already have a question by email. I'll give out the phone number again. It's 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. You do not have to have read these books to participate in the conversation. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And this one actually came in before the show. So these kids were, these are from Sick High School and regard Wanting More.
Okay? Oh, okay.
You ready?
Uh-huh.
So you'll have to give a little background here, but we have three from Ryan. Not one, not two, but three questions. They're all good. So here we go. Ryan says, why did Soraya and Ziba not want Jamila to have the operation? Do you agree with them, or do you support Jamila's decision to have the operation? Now, of course, that's all the plot of the book there.
Actually, no. I don't think it gives away too much. Okay, when I was writing it, I kind of wondered why Soraya and Ziba were so adamant about her not having the operation as well. I think part of it comes down to control. And when in a pecking order situation like the orphanage is, I think Jamila's strength is that she just flies under the radar. She doesn't get involved in any of the politics. She lets them fight it out among themselves, and she just doesn't get involved. And when they were trying to tell her not to do that because of the American soldiers, for one thing, they don't trust the American soldiers. I mean, Saraya says at one point, she says, first they break our country, then they give us a few things. And, you know, how can we trust that? And so they don't trust it. And so that's their fears. That's what. And plus, having her fix her cleft lip, it'll put her in a different category. And she might become more of a social threat to them. So I think they have their own reasons to keep her where she is.
See, this is why one of the things I really love about this book is these details that bring out. I'm not part of any kind of girl pack in an orphanage, okay? But I can remember stuff from middle school that was a whole lot like this.
It is all jockeying for position. Oh my gosh, middle school they're on the cusp of adulthood, and they're all jockeying for who's going to be on top and who's. It's all like alpha male, alpha dog, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, you portray it very well. You must have been there.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh. And you know what the hilarious thing was? The funny thing was when I was writing that part of the book and Jamila was just hands off, I'm not going to get involved. I thought, wow, she's smarter than I ever was. And I actually learned from Jamila in terms of her character. She just did not deign to that level.
I think I learned a few things from her too. She's a very good girl.
Yeah, she is.
She's a very good girl. Her mother dies within the first couple of pages of the book.
Yeah, but the problem is, I think she's good by default. She actually can't afford to be bad because she lives such a tentative existence. She relies on the kindness of everybody just to. I almost felt like she was white knuckling her faith, and she needs to find someone where she could actually relax. And through the whole book, I shouldn't say anything more.
I'll bring out a little bit more about the book, which is. You bring it out very beautifully how she is very observing of her Islamic customs, the prayers and the washing and the way things are supposed to be done. And it's, you draw it very elegantly, coming back to it over and over again, when she's so shocked at the kind of little blasphemies and the little carelessnesses that she sees, and how she reacts to those. She's kind of a good girl in that regard, too.
Well, she's a real village girl. And
yeah,
she sees,
village. There you go.
She's a real village girl. And she's got a very black and white kind of mentality when it comes to a lot of things. And when I was looking at it, I thought, you know, she really mistrusts the westernization that she sees all around her, like all of the Afghans running after the Americans and getting westernized and leaving all their principles behind. And she really mistrusts that. And actually, the only thing she has are her principles. And when I was writing
this, I'm picturing right now, there are people on base right now, mm-hmm. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, uh-huh. who have been deployed uh-huh. in Afghanistan are listening to this.
Oh,
right
really?
Now. Oh, you bet.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, I don't mean to insult anybody.
No. Yeah. It's just that the point of view is extremely interesting. Yeah. A point of view that I think people who I've talked who've been deployed would like to get more of those kinds of insights. They're a little hard to come by.
Well,
sometimes.
Imagine
you're
how
stuck inside of the green, whatever mm-hmm. they called it.
Yeah. Well, imagine how Americans would feel if another force comes and occupies them, and you see everybody around you starting to imitate the new foreigners. You know, I mean, look at the hostility even towards China, and China's rising and stuff like that. So
now there's listeners who are thinking, "Welcome to the res, lady."
Yeah, but right. I mean, when I was writing it, I thought. I would resent it if I was her, and yet at the same time, the Americans help her with her cleft lip. So it's a mixed blessing there, and not all of them are out to get them, and some of them have good hearts and all of that kind of stuff. And in fact, what I did was I spoke to my son-in-law is from Afghanistan. He's from Kandahar, and my sister-in-law is from Kabul. And it's a world of difference. So I actually know a little bit of the cultural differences there. And I asked my son-in-law's mom. She's such a sweet lady. I asked her, how do you feel about the Americans being there? And she said, oh, it's good, because while they're there, there's less fighting. And I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to go completely neutral, and I'm just going to say, this is the fact. This is the way it is. This is, and it's just part of the story. And so I went completely neutral. I kept my own, any prejudices I have, I kept them out.
It's amazing and how much you learn when you do that, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Well, another thing that you bring out in this book, and I'm about to go to Zachary's call from Sitka and then return to Ryan's calls from Sitka, is the value of education.
Yeah.
That's one thing the Taliban brought.
Yeah.
Was they had schools. Well, nobody else had schools.
Did they have schools, the Taliban?
That was the idea.
Well, they had, okay, you know what the problem is, what you have to understand in those kind of countries is that the missionary schools have been established there for ages. And what you found was that the most educated people in the school, in the whole country, had gone to the missionary schools and were basically whitewashed. They lost all their cultural identity. And I think the Taliban and a lot of the ignorant, the people who are reacting to that are reacting to the fact that the top people are losing their faith, they're losing their culture, they're losing their dignity, and they're aping the West. And it's all through the missionary system.
Roxana, we got in hip deep now. let's see what Zachary has to say from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Zachary, and thanks for hanging on so long.
Thank you for letting me talk.
You're welcome. Roxana is with us now.
So I was wondering if we read the book Wanting More in our school, and uh-huh. We wanted to know if Jamila's cleft lip had any metaphorical meaning.
Oh. You know, you know why I gave her a cleft lip? Because I wanted her to be a deep thinker. And the thing is, when I was writing this story, I didn't want her to be a flighty, silly kind of a girl. I wanted her to be a deep thinker. And to be a deep thinker, you actually have to have something wrong or something different about you, because that kind of turns you to inwards. It kind of makes you more look inwards. That's actually, and I didn't want to make it too obvious. Like, I didn't want to make it something huge. So I gave her a cleft lips just so that she would have just something a little bit, because unfortunately being poor and being abandoned isn't unusual enough in Afghanistan to make her the kind of deep thinker that I wanted her to be. So I gave her the cleft lip, but definitely later on, it's definitely a metaphor, because she talks about how she feels all ripped inside because of what her father has done to her. And yeah, definitely, you got it. It's a metaphor. But it didn't start out as that. It started out because I needed her to be a deep thinker, and she had to have something wrong with her, something physical.
Zachary?
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right.
We have two more speakers here that would like to talk to you.
Oh, okay. You want to pass the phone, Zachary? All right. We get this out of Barrow. Every Christmas we do a show where people can say greetings to their relatives.
Oh, how nice.
So this will be an office full of people, and they'll all just pass the phone. They'll all name all of their cousins. All right. Next, from Blatchley Middle School.
Hello.
You're on the radio. Who are you?
My name is Megan Christner.
Hello, Megan. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Megan.
You're on the air with Roxana.
It's so nice to talk to you. I really enjoyed your book, but I have one question.
Okay.
What inspired you to put in the character Arwa?
Arwa, oh, good question. You know, honestly, Megan, when I'm writing the book, I don't think that much. I just write down what happens. And Arwa just showed up. This stinky little girl just showed up. And
we've never known anyone like that ever.
And honestly, I had no idea why she was there. You know, what happens is sometimes the characters, and when I was writing the story, Jamila just took it on herself. Most of the time, I just sat there and I recorded. It's like I could see her going through everything, meeting all these people, going through all of this stuff, and I was just writing it down. And honestly, with Arwa, I had no idea why she was there. But then at the end, I realized that she was there to show how Jamila would overcome her own little prejudices, her own problems, and pass on the mercy of her mother to Arwa, who needed it too.
Right.
Yeah. So she did end up being important. All of them end up being important. Sometimes I don't know until the end why they're there. And then that's basically what happened with Arwa.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. Anybody left there?
Yep. There's one more.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
From Blatchley Middle School, you're on the air with Roxana Khan. How are you doing? Who are you?
I'm good. My name is Breezy. And I want to know, how did you come up with all the fictional characters? Were they like based off people you knew?
No, that couldn't be.
You know what? That's a very good question. I think when I first started, a lot of the times they were based off of someone I knew, and I got into a lot of trouble. But now, actually, I find that sometimes my subconscious, when I'm writing a story, it'll just kind of come up with these amalgams. You know what an amalgam, like, it's where you take a piece of this character, a piece of this person, you know. So I can't really say that any of the characters in there are based on people I know. Except the grandfather. When the grandfather says that thing in the first chapter and she's quoting it, that's my dad. Okay, that's my dad. But other than that, and the father character is so different from my own father. I actually had to do a lot of research into addiction because, you know, thank God there's no addiction in my family at all. We don't drink. We don't do anything like that. So I actually watched a show called Intervention to find out. So I actually did research on a lot of that stuff. The stepmother, not anybody I particularly know, but I just mean ladies I've seen. Okay, I've seen people do petty little mean things like that. So I just kind of absorb that and I spit it back out.
I got one more question.
Go ahead.
Will there be another book following Wanting More?
I tried. You see, I was just, the thing is, when I was writing Jamila's character, I really do feel like she's good by default. She actually hasn't had a chance to be bad because she feels that if she's bad, then she's going to get kicked out. I mean, she really can't even do anything bad because she's so tight in being good. And I thought, you know what? She needs to be able to relax. And I thought, and the funny thing is, I mean, we sold the book to Australia and Japan and all Italy and all kinds. In Italy, they called it Cenerentola a Cabo, which means a Cinderella in Cabo. And I thought, it's not a Cinderella story. If it was a Cinderella story, then the fairy godmother would be the butcher, you know, Agram. And I thought, no, it's not. But then even the Australian publisher said, oh, well, we think it's like a... I said, no, it's a Hansel and Gretel story without the Hansel. And then they said, well, people don't really know Hansel and Gretel
that much.
Yeah, they don't really know Hansel and Gretel as much as they
hilarious.
Know Cinderella. And I thought, okay, well, you know what? I think what I wanted to do at the end, I thought, I want to give her a happy ending because I don't want to give anything away, but I want her to really actually be happy. And I thought, she needs to find a really nice guy, a nice guy who will bring her out of it and so she can actually relax. And I thought, when I was doing that, I thought, yeah, but the problem is when you've been so tight and so good for so long, when you relax a little bit, you're going to have to be a little bit obnoxious for a little while. You're going to, until you learn how to kind of temper yourself, the power will get to your head a little bit. So I actually did write a sequel and it was rejected. The publisher didn't recognize Jamila and I thought, okay, well, we'll see what happens. But it's such a good story. And that one I'm still going to fix it. And I want to finish it because she just finds her prince charming and he's a really nice guy. He's really, really a cute guy. He's just a sweetheart. So that's what I'm working on too. But I want to get that finished. But the publisher that published Wanting More, they didn't like it. They just said, nope. So we'll see what happens with it.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right. Yeah, that was a great question. I got a great a great answer. Let's try one more before the break here. Jenny, who calls from Ellensburg, Washington. Welcome to Talk Alaska with Roxana Khan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Roxana, I wanted to say I was a Battle of the Books coach the year that Wanting More was a battle book in Sitka.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that our group found really interesting in discussing the book were sort of those universal experiences, specifically about what happens to children when their mothers pass away. And I told them the story of my father-in-law, that when his mother passed away and his father remarried, all the children were sent to a Presbyterian settlement school.
Oh, my goodness.
And then others shared stories in their own families about children after they had lost their mother who were adopted out to other family members or married off or sent on their own. And so I really enjoyed with your book kind of those cultural universals. And one of the things I really liked about Wanting More was sort of the reconciliation that she has with her father and stepbrother and stepmother through the marriage of her friend. And I wanted you to comment on why you chose to have a marriage be the point of reconciliation for them.
Well, that kind of surprised me myself. I mean, when she kind of makes her way back into her father's life, and Soraya kind of starts flirting with Masood, I thought, whoa, what's happening there? And like I said before in the show, often the characters will do things that I had no plans on what they're going to do. With Wanting More, what I did was I gave it to my son-in-law's sisters. They actually are two girls who wear the face cover. They live in Toronto, but they cover their faces. They're very traditional, and they're Afghan and everything. And I wanted them to tell me if I had made some cultural faux pas. And they were the ones who told me. They originally, I didn't have that kind of reconciliation. I just kind of, because I didn't even think that Jamila really needed it. And then it was funny because my son-in-law's sister, she was the one who said, you know, why doesn't the stepmom just kick out the dad? And I thought, would she? And she goes, yeah, she would kick him out. And I thought, really, she would divorce him? Of course she would divorce him and everything she'd give. But the funny thing was my other son-in-law, who's Egyptian, he read the book and he loved it. And he said, no, the father left on his own. He did not, I'm giving away the ending. I'm sorry, spoiler alert. But yeah, anyway, so a lot of that reconciliation came from my son-in-law's sister, because she wanted there to be a kind of a confrontation. And she said, she said, that's not enough. There's got to be. And I thought, OK, fine. So I actually listened to her and I thought, OK, I mean, personally, I was satisfied with just her moving on. But I thought, no, okay, let's bring it back. And then when Soraya was flirting with Masood, I thought, ooh, looks like something's going on here. And yeah, it just kind of went that way. And I mean, Jamila would not go with Masood, but he was too much of a brother to her. But yeah, so it just kind of, these are some of the things that happen. Sometimes you have no expectation it's going to happen, but it does. And your characters just have a mind of their own and they do things you had no idea they were going to do.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for being part of the program.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Hey, Jenny, do you think, would you read a sequel?
Oh, I definitely would.
I knew it.
we had been reading Does My Head Look Big in This?
Ah!
I can't remember the name of the author now. And so we had just wonderful conversations because I grew up in Appalachia where there are Baptist Old Believers who cover their head.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, we just had so many wonderful conversations about kind of cultural universals, and I would love to read a sequel where she gets to be a mom.
Oh, wow.
I would like a sequel to end with her. Her getting to be a mom and getting to have a daughter.
Yeah. What if the sequel were funny? Because I'm sick of sad stories.
Oh, you know, that's one of the things that we loved a lot about Does My Head Look Big in This?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was funny.
It was. Well, I want to make the sequel a romantic comedy. That's what I was trying to do.
But it would be wonderful for me if she gets to have a daughter.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree.
I think that would be a wonderful thing for her.
Uh-huh. It would really come full circle.
Jenny, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From down Washington State, our guest is Roxana Khan, author of Wanting More and The Big Red Lollipop, which we'll get to when we get back to Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. and by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Juvenile fiction with a bite. I would characterize Roxana Khan's work as being like that. Even Big Red Lollipop. I mean, here is a there's a birthday party. A girl gets a lollipop. Her little sister eats it. I mean, you wouldn't think there'd be a bite there, but there actually is. And this is truly a children's classic, I have to say.
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's won all kinds of awards. I'm not the only
yeah.
one saying that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It has. It's won, oh my gosh, it won the Charlotte Zolotow Award and the Golden Kite.
I can't wait to send it to my grandkids, even though they're all kind of a little too old for it, maybe. But this business of I've watched their parents always talking to them about sharing.
Uh-huh.
This one drums at home.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
It's actually based on a true story. It took me 10 years to write this book. For 10 years, I was telling this story. This one started as an oral tale. And the funny thing is, I was telling it from my point of view. I'm actually in the story. Guess who I am in the story?
You're the bratty little sister?
Yes, I am. I am Sana. And the funny thing is, okay, I mean, I thought it's going to be obvious. My name is Rook Sana.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I took off the Rook and I thought, okay, I'm Sana. and you should read some of the online reviews. They really slash at Sana because they can't stand her. But that they don't realize that Sana is actually the one writing the story. And it, in a way, writing the story was my penance to my big sister, my older sister.
And you really did leave her a little triangle of her
life. I did. But the thing is, there's one thing I changed.
And she threw it into the...
Everything in the story is
and
absolutely...
And you went after it underneath
yep,
the couch.
I did.
Oh,
everything in that story really happened except one thing.
Yeah.
And I told that story in front of my older sister one time before she passed away. I told it in front of her. And I was kind of nervous because she was in the audience and I thought, she's going to know what I changed. There's one major thing I changed. And I finished it and she was laughing louder than everybody else in the audience. And she came up to me afterwards. She knew right away what I had changed. And she said to me, she said, wait a minute, you never gave me that big green lollipop. I said, yeah, I know, but I should have. So that's the one thing I changed. I ate the big green lollipop too, but I should have given it to her.
You just gave the whole thing away, Roxana.
I know. And the thing is, when I was writing it, it was funny because I wrote it from my perspective. And then my editor at Viking, she was the one who said, Roxana, I love this story, but why don't you let Rabina tell this story? Because she's a more sympathetic character. And I thought, oh, okay. So I rewrote it in 15 minutes. I sent it up and it became this huge bestseller and award winner. And
gorgeous.
In fact, when I was writing it, I showed myself, Sana, I showed myself no mercy whatsoever. And everything that I just said, yeah, I made myself as naughty as I really was.
It's amazing what you can accomplish if you're willing to make a fool out of yourself.
No, I don't think I made a fool of myself. Because honestly, what 3 or 4 year old isn't like that? Isn't self-centered. And, you know, you have to learn to come out of that. And it was funny because for a long time, I was just telling the first part of the story to the point where I actually ate the triangle too.
Oh.
I was telling, and then I thought, but that's not a resolution. There's not. And then I remembered, I thought, what happened? And then I remembered years later that my sister had intervened. And when I came running home for the first time, being invited to a birthday party, and I thought, oh, that was so sweet of her. It didn't occur to me when I was growing up how sweet it really was.
Now,
until...
I hope your sister got this message before she died.
Yeah, well, she heard me telling the story. I just wish she could have seen the book because she would have seen how much people love her story. That was her. Yeah, that was her.
Let's go to Bob, joins the program from Prince of Wales Island. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Roxana Khan, Bob.
Shalom, Madam Khan.
Wa alaikum salam.
Pardon me?
Wa alaikum as-salam, I just replied.
Oh, okay. I knew the first part. I didn't know the response. I just wanted to comment on, I love your storytelling, just your delivery, your eloquence, and your use of syntax, and yada, yada, yada. The other thing, or a couple things, is I like the themes of your stories.
Oh, thank you.
Seems like they're self-reliance with dignity. You know, you're going to make it, and you ain't going to hurt nobody on the way. As far as depicting violence is out there. Young folks need to know how to deal with it, you know, as long as it's not vicarious.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
Okay, as far as your young person in Afghanistan with the blue eyes and the freckles and the blonde hair,
uh-huh.
You think Alexander the Great needs Greek crew for on the way through.
Probably. Apparently there's a lot of Mongol blood down there too, so they've been invaded a lot.
Hey, Genghis Khan.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Europe.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Bob, thanks so much for the call.
Oh, I have one more question, partner, real quick to your guest. I'm a biblio geek, and to me, I need to ask you a question. What do you think about electronic books? To me, a book's a soul. A room without a book has no soul. How are you going to store a library in the cloud, you know?
Yeah.
What are you going to do when the batteries quit?
Well, I hear you. You know, and the funny thing is I finally made the transition to an e-reader myself, and it's not the same. I'm reading The Brothers Karamazov, and I read Crime and Punishment on my e-reader, and it's not the same because I don't feel the book. You know, I don't feel the book, and yet it's a lot lighter to carry. I think any way people are reading...
Don't drop it in the bathtub.
No, I haven't done that yet. But it's a lot easier to carry, and it was great because I got the books for free.
That's always handy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I probably wouldn't have picked them up otherwise. So I'm thinking that any way people are reading, if it's e-readers or I think e-books are with us to stay. And personally, yeah,
well,
I like having a book in front of myself.
Argument.
Yeah, I like having the book.
Anybody you can turn on to the joy of reading is another soul you've gained.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think it occupies a different part of your brain, and it's just there's no comparison between reading and watching movies and stuff like that.
No boob tube. Oh,
yeah.
I didn't want to say it, but I had to.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mom. My mom says that too, Bob. She always said that. Well,
yeah. It,
thanks for your call.
If you want instant idiocy, turn the TV on.
Oh, come on. Not that bad.
Well, okay, not quite. Okay, well, I'll let you folks go. Enjoy talking to you.
Thank you.
I'm going to find one of your books, ma'am. Just read it.
Oh, thank you.
Have a good time in Alaska.
Oh, I am.
All right, let's go to the Carrie. Joins us from Blatchley in Sitka. Is that right?
Yes.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Roxana. I'm glad you made it to Anchorage.
Me
your
too.
Your plane flew.
It was touch and go there.
Oh, yes.
Valdez was quite busy and quite snowy during the conference there recently where Roxana presented.
Yeah.
And I'm calling on behalf of the Spirit of Reading program that I work together with Bo Hedrick at the high school here in Sitka. And we run this program through an interlibrary cooperation grant through the Alaska State Library and the Institute of Museum and Libraries. And we are so happy to have you as our featured author this year, Roxana.
Oh, I'm honored. I'm absolutely honored.
Carrie, you knocked it out of the park this year.
Why, thank you. And thank you very much for having Roxana on.
Yes, thank you.
I look
Mr.
forward
Arnold.
To these shows every year.
We'll be in touch again then.
Absolutely.
I'll see you later, Carrie.
You got any more kids for us?
We have those same three kids here.
The same ones? No.
Yes. And I believe there's some kids at the high school that are waiting to call in.
Okay, well, hopefully they will call.
Okay, thank you.
You give them a jab or something, will you? We only got like 15 minutes left.
I will give them a jab right now.
Okay. Ryan sent his by email, by the way, and we were dealing with Ryan's questions earlier from the high school about wanting more. And his last question, he said, and I think we've covered this one, are you satisfied with the end of the book?
And, yeah, definitely. I think the book ends on a hopeful note.
But you might still do a sequel.
Oh, yeah, I still want to do it because actually at the end of it, I still think she needs to get to a place where she can relax, you know, and she hasn't gotten to that place yet.
She needs to relax. I love that. What does it, this is the other question. What does it say about Jamila's father that instead of leaving her in front of the orphanage to begin with, I'm really going to be interested in your answer to this.
Uh-huh.
He leaves her on a random street corner.
Oh, I just don't think he thinks. He's just a person who just does things and doesn't think through the ramifications. I think some people, what I think is that sometimes some men, especially in Afghanistan and in third world countries, when they're being raised, I guess they're such little princes and they're kind of used to having things done for them that once they're on their own and they're obligated to be responsible, they don't know how. And he only thinks of himself. When I was researching his character and trying to figure out what kind of guy would do this to his daughter, I had to kind of work backwards because the Afghan culture is very family oriented. It's very connected. And even in my own family, when my brother-in-law did this and he ran off, the rest of our family, we got together and we nurtured my nephew and my niece. And they're fine. They're doing just great. My nephew's working in England. He graduated from Cambridge with a master's in economics. And my niece is becoming a physician's assistant. And that's because the rest of the family, I thought something had to have happened that the family structure is gone. And because also sometimes a man wouldn't do that if he knows that the rest of the family is going to be judging him and looking down on him for doing something like that. So he's just a really weak guy. And when I was researching him, I thought he's an opium addict. And I watched Intervention to kind of figure out addicts and stuff like that. And one thing I noticed about all the addicts on the shows was that they were all incredibly selfish people. It was all about them. They didn't care if people around them were crying their eyes out and trying to beg them to get their life together. They didn't care. It was all about them getting high. And I thought, okay, this is the kind of person he is. He doesn't really think. Yeah, he could have taken her to an orphanage, but that would have been a bit too thought out. It would be a bit too calculated for him.
I think you could have gone to a few AA meetings and gotten a lot more insight than that.
I don't think they've got AA over there. I think they need it, but they don't have it over there.
Right. It's not like the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, huh?
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you know, the opium is, I mean, that's a major economic mainstay of Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's an economic mainstay, but it's also killing them. Oh my gosh, it's killing them. It's like, it's too cheap over there for them. They can just easily get high on that. And it's like, it's an endemic. Hmm. Oh, it's just an endemic there.
Well, yeah, I that's the kind of answer I was expecting, that he's kind of in a panic. He's not even really himself.
Yeah.
This is a situation that if it had occurred, there had been some kind of family trauma. The guy loses his wife.
Yeah.
He has this little girl. He's got his new wife.
Yeah.
And
she's
wealthy. In the city.
Yeah.
And he's probably not all that comfortable in the city, but it offers him easier to get opium and all that.
Yeah.
And this woman is not going to abide this little girl. Normally, there is no normal. Mm-hmm. But with no extended family,
yeah,
that's probably what would have been the safety valve of a situation like this.
Yeah,
exactly as you said.
Yeah, it's actually the social pressure. Because you do that in front of extended family, they're thinking, what are you doing? We would take her. And there's nobody around to say that to him. So there's no reason why he wouldn't just do the easy thing.
Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. It's your last chance to get in a call for any part of the conversation you want to have with Roxana Khan, author of The Big Red Lollipop, Wanting More, The Rose in My Carpets, Bedtime Balk, which this is one we haven't talked about yet, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The University of Alaska Anchorage, the ultimate cross-trainer for finding your place in the world, home to stellar academic programs and an exciting campus energy with all of the thrills you'll only find outside of an office or classroom. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Every year in the springtime, we have an Alaska Spirit of Reading program, and the school librarians provide us with the author of a book, which the kids in the school libraries have been reading. And it's always fun. It's always fun to hear the questions that the kids come up with. It's also always fun to read the books, because these are invariably people of quality and great radio guests. And that's the case this time. Rukhsana Khan, who comes from Pakistan, but really was raised in Canada.
Yeah.
And is an observing Muslim and writes a kind of fiction that reflects...
I'd say universal themes.
Well, village life.
Yeah.
You don't shy away from war.
Yeah.
You know, the character just sort of shows up in the book that he's missing his leg, you know?
Yeah.
He just shows up in the book. There he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were telling me that you didn't start out to be a writer. And I thought, well, no, she's a storyteller that started writing books. And he said, no, that's not the case either. I started writing.
Yeah.
And how did you know that you were good at it?
Actually, I didn't. I grew up reading books. They literally saved my life, because growing up in Dundas, feeling like you're dirty, having everybody always making fun, especially of the things that you hold dear, like your religious values and stuff like that, that was really, really hard. And my escape was books. I didn't do drugs. I still say I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I do desserts. But growing up, the books actually literally saved my life. They kept me going, because when I was reading books, I could be someone else. I could be somewhere else. It wasn't until a grade 8 teacher, he's the one who told me first that I was a writer. And I thought, really? I could be a writer? And I thought, nah. Writers are white people, and they're from England and America. This is what I thought. And I thought, no, I can't. But I started to dream about it. And actually, I slowly started. When I was 13, I kind of started to kind of think, maybe I could, maybe I could. And it wasn't until I was about 27 that I seriously started writing. And I wrote the most horrendous, awful stuff. And it took me 8 years to get my first book published. And that's bedtime book. What happened was...
So you went to... You went to the juvenile field. You didn't always try to...
I always wanted the juvenile field.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I always... Because the thing is, I love children's books. I think children's books, they get to the point. Like a lot of the adult books, they meander all over the place. And you're thinking, okay, get to the point, get to the point. But children's books, you got to get to the point. You have to... And the thing is, I thought there's so many bad books written about Muslims, like bad books written by maybe well-meaning authors, but they're crap. And I wanted to tell our stories. Like, I thought, you know, we're not like that. You know, you think we're a bunch of barbarians and stuff like that. We're not like that. We have reasons for thinking the way we do. And I thought the best way to do that would be through books, because, I mean, I looked at the Jewish community, how one book transformed them from other to people that the people that could be related to. And I'm talking, of course, of the Diary of Anne Frank. And I thought, we need to do that with the Muslim community too, because right now we are like the other. People look at us, especially after September 11th, and they think, oh, we're all a bunch of maniacs or something like that. And we're not. You know, yeah, there were a few people who did some bad things, but every group has their bad apples and stuff. And really, we're not like that. Most of us are, well, we're all law-abiding. We're like really harmless. And we have silly chickens, funny chickens. We have big red lollipops. We have funny stories. We have sad stories. So that's what I thought I would do. And it was really, really hard at the time. And we were pretty poor. I used to babysit. I used to do daycare to make some money. And I was taking care of my own kids. And this was in 1996. And I was trying to be an author. I was writing and stuff. And I used to take care of this really nasty little kid. He was about 3 years old. Oh, he was disgusting. One time he actually stuck his head in the toilet after he peed. Okay, that's the kind of kid he was. Oh, he was only 3 years. And I used to have to take care of him because I needed the money. And one morning I got up for Fajr. We pray 5 times a day. And the first prayer is always the hardest. It was summertime. And Fajr is prayed before the sun rises. And the sun rises in summertime about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning in Toronto. So I had to get up out of my warm, cozy bed. And before we pray, we wash a lot. We make wudu. We wash our hands 3 times, mouth 3 times, nose 3 times, face 3 times, right arm to the left arm, right arm to the elbow 3 times, left arm to the elbow 3 times. We wet our hair, we clean our ears, and we wash our feet, both feet, right foot first and ankle to the ankles and stuff. And then we go and pray. It only takes, the prayer takes about 5 minutes. But then I couldn't get back to sleep. And I thought, oh no, that kid is coming at 7:30. If I don't get some sleep, I'm going to strangle him. And I thought, I got to get some sleep. So I was tossing and turning. And I thought, okay, let me try to count sheep. You know, I heard of counting sheep. And I thought, okay, I made my mind all blank. I imagined a fence and I imagined some sheep. And I said, okay, sheep, start jumping. But there was an old ram. And he was kind of chatting up a young ewe in the corner. And I said, come on, sheep, start jumping. And I said, and the old ram, he looks at me like this. And he goes, who the heck are you? I started laughing. I thought, this is too funny. You know, he's talking back to me. And so I got up and I thought, forget about trying to sleep. I'm going to write a story. And that became Bedtime Bawk. And I called it Bawk because B-A-L-K, you don't want to do something, but these are sheep, so they bawk. That's why it's called Bedtime Bawk.
That's very childish.
It was became my first book that got published.
So here's this, you make it a kid. It's not you.
Yeah.
A child trying to go to sleep and imagining the sheep.
Yeah.
And the sheep talk back to him.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is there's actually an Islamic joke in there.
Uh-huh.
And you said the Sufi story.
Yeah,
yeah, it's like a Sufi story. But because I was thinking about it and I thought, and there's actually a verse in the Quran. And only one person in about 15 years has ever figured it out on their own. Because she's the daughter of an imam, from the masjid. And one day she had bought the book and she was reading it to her daughter. And she called me and she said, Roxana, is that what I think it is? I said, yes. Finally, someone figured it out. Because there's a line in there where the girl says, because these sheep are really rambunctious and the old ram leads them in mutiny and everything. And finally, she says, listen, sheep, if you don't do what I say, I can make more sheep who will obey and be good, who will jump over my fence and do as they're told. And I put that line in there. And when I put it in there, I was laughing my head off. And my editor said, oh, we should make it more easy. And I said, no, that's actually a joke. And she said, well, I don't get it. I said, no, you're not going to get it. But some Muslims might get it. Basically, there's a line in the Quran, in our holy book, where God says to mankind, listen, mankind, if your whole society were to disobey me, I would raise up a new one that would obey me. And if everybody never committed a sin, I would replace them with another society that did sin so I could forgive them. So that's actually, it's a parallel to what God says to mankind.
Oh my God, you have just provided the perfect ending for this program, Roxana Khan.
I had such a good time, Steve.
I'm blown away. We've never had a soft landing quite like this one. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
I really hope you enjoy
the remainder of your visit.
Oh,
Alaska.
I'm sure I will. I love Alaska.
Next week on Talk of Alaska, it's going to be orca whale researcher Eva Salidas. Really looking forward to this one. Back to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.